It is 60 degrees outside our studios in downtown Coshocton. And this hour is a paid remote with Nick Teddy and Tim Kettler from Coshocton Environmental and Community Awareness. And we do have on the telephone Teresa Mills, organizer for the Ohio Field Office and Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. How are you today?
I am fine.
Can you, before we get into injection wells, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
My background started over 20 years ago when my neighborhood, we started experiencing a lot of odd diseases, children with bone tumors, and we started doing some tracking and tracked some emissions to the old Columbus trash burning power plant. We were able to get that plant shut down, as well as all of the other trash incinerators in the state, within a year. From there, it was kind of unusual for something like that to happen, so I became the jack of all trades and masters of none. People started calling me, asking me, how did you do that? You know, what can we do? And so it's just snowballed from there. So I've been doing the work in Ohio for, like I said, over 20 years.
And injection wells, a lot of talk, a lot of activity with injection wells and hydraulic fracturing here in the state of Ohio and Coshocton County. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts and my concerns are the more production wells that are drilled, the more and more injection wells we are going to need. Currently, Ohio has 234 wells, injection wells permitted, and 202 of those are active. The industry and ODNR likes to say that, you know, across the country there's, you know, 144,000 injection wells, but only 30,000 of those are actually Class 2 disposal wells, so I think it's a little disingenuous for them to be saying that, you know, what Ohio has is a very small number compared to the nation, when that, in fact, is not the truth. In 2013, last year, which is the last records that we have, of course, you know, we don't have 14 yet, but the state of Ohio injected, or into the state of Ohio soil, was injected over 16 million barrels of brine. Over half of that came from out-of-state oil and gas wells. That's, you know, over 686 million gallons of brine that was injected into Ohio soils. And for that, the state of Ohio, if the brine is coming in from out-of-state, the state receives 20 cents a barrel, and there's 42 gallons in a barrel. And if it's in-state brine, they receive a nickel per barrel. So for all of the waste that was injected in 2013, ODNR only made $1,946 and some odd cents for, you know, using our soil as a deposit for this material. Now, in Coshocton, in that same tie-in period in 2013, five injection wells in Coshocton County took in 1,285,069 barrels. But the majority of that was injected into just one well, and that being the Buckeye Brine well at 1,220,000 barrels. What is one of the things that's disturbing about that is the state, when I talked about the fee, the nickel for in-state waste and 20 cents for out-of-state waste, there is a limit on how much they're required to pay for, and that limit is 500,000 barrels. So the one well in Coshocton took in twice the amount that they actually had to pay the state the fee for. And I think that's pretty amazing that Ohio and Ohioans are subjected to this waste, and there is absolutely no money to be made for either the state of Ohio or for the local counties. Local counties do not get any of the fees, except, and they have all of the burden of the truck traffic and the odors that come from these facilities and the problems that they can produce in the future.
What is the incentive, or what do you believe is the incentive for a company to ship their wastewater away from where it was originally used? In other words, why isn't it disposed of on site?
Well, they used to dispose of the waste on site, and that was called annular disposal. So they would pull out the oil and gas and the brine, and then inject the brine right back down into the annulus of the well, which is the outer casing. And they found that created a great deal of trouble. And Ohio is one of the only states that still allows annular disposal, if not the only state that still allows that. The incentive, there is no incentive for the waste to remain, like in Pennsylvania, there's no incentive for it to remain there. The U.S. EPA regulates or permits injection wells in Pennsylvania, where here in Ohio, it's the Ohio Department of Transportation. So there's, and Ohio seems to like injection wells. So the more that they can bring in, it seems like the more they like it.
And, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So there's no incentive for, Pennsylvania, it takes one permit. I just read that is now under appeal. Took like 3 years to get the permit. In the state of Ohio, you can get a permit in less than 45 days.
So it's essentially cheaper and easier just to bring it to Ohio.
Oh, absolutely. Even with the trucking cost, it's still cheaper to bring it to Ohio, yes.
So what are your thoughts, or what would you like to see done about injection well regulation in the state of Ohio?
Well, I would like to see some injection well regulations that were actually meaningful. I know under House Bill 59, which was actually a budget bill, that they like to slip in, these controversial laws, because they know they have to pass. There was some, ODNR was supposed to produce some rules on new facilities, what they call new facilities, that would treat or store or dispose of this brine. Well, when we started reviewing the pre-draft rules, we realized that these are not really new facilities, as I would think of as, being new technology. These are just new to Ohio, because Ohio never allowed, the large impoundments or the downblending of radioactive waste before, which they will be doing now. So it's not new technology, it's just new to Ohio. What I would like to see happen is actually new technology that is not a threat. There is not the threat of radioactive isotopes being released into the environment. In my opinion, if they can't find a more legitimate way to handle this waste, then they shouldn't be producing it. We shouldn't have the burden of this experiment that they're doing with this, rapid extraction of this, of the oil and gas that creates so much waste without someplace to put it. It's unconscionable.
And is there already such a technology in existence that you would be happy with, or has it yet to be developed?
Well, there are ways that, the radioactive isotopes could be removed from the waste, but it's very, very, very expensive. You know, to me, that, you know, it's not coming out of my pocket, so I don't care, and that's what they should be doing. You know, recently there was a story about the leachate at a landfill in West Virginia that is now seeing an increase in their radioactivity coming out in their leachate. And several facilities in Ohio send their solids to, you know, to the landfills in West Virginia.
We're talking today with Teresa Mills. She is an organizer for the Ohio Field Office and Center for Health, Environment, and Justice, and broadcasts with Nick Teddy and Tim Kettler from Coshocton Environmental and Community Awareness. We'll continue right after these words. It is 928, 60 degrees in downtown Coshocton, and again, this hour is a paid commercial broadcast with Coshocton Environmental and Community Awareness. We have on the telephone Teresa Mills, organizer for the Ohio Field Office and Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. And earlier, Teresa, you mentioned facilities that were permitted by the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. Would you like to expand on that?
I would, thank you. Under House Bill 59, as I mentioned earlier, which, again, was the budget bill, ODNR was to write regulations for these types of facilities. And until they got the regulations written, they were going to allow these facilities to build and operate prior to rules. Starting in January, well, the end of December through that 6th of this month, I think, they've issued 23 facilities, what they call director's orders. They're not permits. They're just orders saying, okay, you can go ahead and operate. Doesn't mean that ODNR actually determined that the operations were safe or that the what they were planning to do would actually work. ODNR just rubber-stamped these facilities. And again, before rules were even written for these types of operations, several of these facilities will downblend the radioactive isotopes with materials such as sawdust, auto fluff, tire fluff, in an attempt to try to make the waste less radioactive, when in reality, they're just making more waste radioactive. They're not solidifying, or they're not encapsulating the radioactive material. They're just trying to downblend it to make it less radioactive so it can be put into a local landfill. Or it can be sent out of state such as to West Virginia. Another facility that they have said, okay, go ahead, will build a 10 million gallon surface impoundment for the storage of fluid waste to be used at other sites. Well, that may sound like a good thing to reuse the waste. It's actually an open impoundment, or a big, like a swimming pool. And because of the chemicals that are still in the waste, such as benzene, toluene, xylene.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were mid-thought there. What else would you like to share with us, either about injection wells or those facilities you were just talking about?
Well, I think that on the impoundments, the important thing on that is, you know, in Pennsylvania, they've had some of these impoundments, and they've caused a great deal of problems for the locals because of the off-gassing. The smells become horrendous, and they've actually had to close some of those facilities. The ODNR will be writing rules, hopefully here shortly, on these types of facilities, such as what are they going to do with the radioactive waste, how are they going to handle it, Hopefully, you know, the listeners, when those rules come out, will take the opportunity to write comments to ODNR and let ODNR know that we don't think that that's necessarily a good idea. You know, again, if they can't find something better to do with this waste, then they shouldn't be producing it.
All right. Teresa, anything else that you would like to share with our listeners today before we wrap up?
No, I think that's about it.
Well,
thank you for
being with us. That's Teresa Mills, organizer for the Ohio Field Office and Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. And our broadcast with Nick Teddy and Tim Kettler from Coshocton Environmental and Community Awareness continues after these words. Cloudy skies today with showers likely this morning, then partly sunny with a chance of showers this afternoon. Near steady temperatures around 60. Chance of rain is 70%. Tonight mostly cloudy in the evening, then becoming a partly cloudy, lows in the mid-30s. And for tomorrow, mostly sunny with highs in the mid-50s. It is currently 60 degrees in downtown Coshocton. And we are back with our, this is a paid remote with Coshocton Environmental and Community Awareness, Nick Teddy and Tim Kettler alongside right now. And Tim, we talked to Teresa about injection wells and the ODNR permitted facilities. What would you like to add to her comments?
Well, Mike, I think that Teresa really brings up some very important points, that when you plan for a heavy industrial development that oil and gas development is, I think your first concern has to be, how do we handle the waste? I mean, any planning that goes into new manufacturing or any kind of industrial enterprise always starts with planning, how do we handle the waste that we're going to generate? It's going to be inevitable. And, you know, a lot of times, as far as these commercial enterprises are concerned, it's a cost-benefit analysis. Is it worth it to us to do this type of activity when we have to contend with all the cost of regulation and disposal and the actual production? So to me, it's a very high price that we're going to pay. This is the next generation of radioactive nuclear waste that we dealt with years and years ago, and it sparked a very popular program and a popular public outcry in the form of no nukes. And we see this growing across the nation and the state, that people, as they become aware of this intense industrial development and all the other side issues, which really are very many more than what we've discussed to this point, you sit down and you do the cost-benefit analysis, and is this really worth it? And in my personal opinion, no, of course not. We have a lot of viable alternatives that we can begin to transition to. I mean, oil and gas development and use will be here with us for a good long while, and the gas is touted as a transitional fuel to move us to a cleaner economy. So we're pointing in the right direction, but getting there has a very heavy cost, and feet dragging is going to slow us down and just increase the cost both financially and environmentally. A big part of oil and gas development in Ohio, and particularly in our area and in the northern Appalachian foothills where the shale plays are conveniently located, are economic, of course. You know, job creation is a big issue with us. I mean, it's very easy to go out into our community here and see the need for new jobs for folks. But, you know, once again, that trade-off, are we heading the right direction, or are we just shutting ourselves off to think outside the box to really generate jobs through alternative fuels and through new methods that carry a lot less environmental cost? This particular program, I mean, whether the operators like to hear it or not, this is toxic waste. It contains toxic materials that spoil water that is billions of years old and injects it into the ground in what may be an unstable area. And as Teresa said, this is experimental. You know, our technology is flying much faster than the science on this, and that's a dangerous area to be in. And to do it on the cheap, and ODNR seems to be pretty content to do it on the cheap, and collect a fee on only 500,000 barrels when the potential for the intrastate traffic and interstate traffic, the volumes that could be disposed of for free and generating no revenue for the state, seems to be a real giveaway. And the operators, just like with sales tax, I own a small business, and we collect sales tax, and you know, it's a function that requires bookkeeping and work, and the state is willing to pay small business for their work in collecting that sales tax. It, you know, I think Coshocton sales tax at 7%. It, usually when we collect it, we see about a half a percent for our costs in collecting that sales tax. Well, this state fee on the brine well dumping can be is collected by the operator and can be anywhere up to 3% of the proceeds of that fee. So not only are we capping the fee at a half million barrels, but we're also giving the operator who's collecting that fee what, once again, seems to be a windfall. So selling this as an economic boon as still has it remains to be seen for sure.
What ideally, what do you believe that we should be doing as a nation to fulfill our energy needs and protect the environment at the same time, be it for transportation or electricity, et cetera?
Well, you know, it's reasonable to understand that a transition has to be orderly, and it's going to include what, you know, we can term as obsolete technologies. Fossil fuels are becoming an obsolete resource because, let's face it, it's finite. It's can only last so long. And although we will certainly continue to employ their use, concentrating on other viable resources and green energy that leaves no carbon footprint can also create the same amount of jobs as our former manufacturing base that this country's economy really, which really when the engine of the economy was steaming full speed down the track, it was manufacturing. Well, we can do the same in converting to durable goods towards green energy. It seems like renewables and the related industries that are carry a less carbon footprint get crumbs of research and development money, get crumbs of tax breaks, get crumbs of support from the government compared to what is given to what I see as an obsolete technology. So we really need to focus on not just the necessity of going green. And I want to say, you know, today is Earth Day, so this is really appropriate, and I feel proud, and this is a great opportunity for us to talk about environmental issues on Earth Day here. But all this is viable, all this is doable, but we need to escalate our priorities. What does it mean to us? And today is a good day for everybody to reflect on that. This carbon footprint is what we're going to leave our children and our grandchildren. And we're getting trapped in a box, and we're not thinking of new ways. We're not being creative, and we're not using our ingenuity as a country that we've always been able to do in the past.
Where does hydropower and solar energy and wind energy and geothermal, all those technologies, how do they fit into the equation? And what are the barriers?
Well, I would say the biggest barrier is governmental support. You know, once again, we're here today, and we're doing some of our work and outreach to the community thanks to some grants we received from organizations that support what we're doing. And that's also the role of government, is to support. You know, if we're going to be a marketplace driven economy, we should be out there supporting a lot of these things. And all these technologies, the beauty of all these technologies is they're very doable on a small scale in your home. You can viably generate your own electricity. And one of our previous radio guests, Bill Baker, he was running all his lights on his house off of solar. Of course, hydro, you're kind of limited to what your particular situation on your property is. But, you know, in the right place, and once again, let's look at this as a country. What are we doing as a whole country for consumption? Well, not everybody can do the same thing, but everybody can do something. And All these technologies are doable on a very small scale and will help us to make this transition and, you know, change our thinking. And it, you know, I mentioned in a previous program about conservation, and yeah, it's a new world, and we're going to see things differently, and we're going to have to do things differently. You know, it's a tough sell when you try to do something proactively before the tragedy strikes, but it's much easier to say, I told you so afterwards, and everybody's up in arms and ready to do something. Well, you know, what we're doing is difficult because we're really trying to be out in front of the curve and help people make this a willing change. You know, you catch many more flies with honey than vinegar. And so trying to get this out here so people do this willingly helps us as a community, actually as a society, to make this necessary change, especially as important as energy has played to us, you know, to us in what is a transportation society.
That is Tim Kettler from Coshocton Environmental and Community Awareness, and we need to take a break. We'll be back one more time right after these words. It is 9:51, and we are back once again on this paid commercial broadcast with Nick Teddy and Tim Kettler with Coshocton Environmental and Community Awareness. We want to run down the details of the event, Living on the Shale, that's coming up. But, Tim, some other thoughts you'd like to share before we do that?
Yeah, Mike. You know, this can be overwhelming, having a discussion about global warming. It's a very complex issue, and it's a lot of information to digest. It requires a lot of work, and sometimes it's not that happy of a pursuit when you consider what the possible outcomes could be. So, you know, CECA, Coshocton Environmental and Community Awareness, you know, we started our group so that we could connect people with the environment, you know. And if you break these large issues down into something manageable and begin to come together, and once again, Earth Day is an appropriate day to have these thoughts and do a little introspection that raises our priorities about our ecosystem, our environment, and how we treat the Earth. And something as simple as littering, picking up trash. I'm going to go home today and clean the stretch of road that runs by my house. You know, I'm cleaning it up for myself, but it also gives me a chance to get out there, walk along the woods, and think a little bit about what all this means. And everybody can do that in their home, even if it's changing a light bulb to an LED efficient light bulb or having some water control on their faucets, all these little things. I know you're a big supporter of the national parks, as are myself and my family, and we've traveled to, I think, 30 of them and camped in them, and one thing you can't help but notice is how clean they are. And it's not because of this huge budget that the National Park Service has. You know, we see it dwindling all the time. It's because people connect to it, they care about it, and they become part of it. And little acts, just as what we're describing, help us to do that. And at that point, we're a little bit more in tune with our priorities, and we can take on some of these more weighty issues.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Tim. Nick, would you like to share with us about the event coming up May 17th once again?
Again, it's called Living on the Shale, Saturday, May 17th, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Coshocton Village Inn, 115 North Water Street, Coshocton, Ohio. There is a website that you can go to, www.ceca.org, for full details about the event and the program.
And again, thank you both for being with us today. A few seconds, Tim, any final thoughts?
Yeah, Mike. Oftentimes people, when they're learning of new issues, there's two things that they face. Where do I get the information? And once I get the information, what do I do with it? And folks can find out the answers to both of those questions at Living on the Shale, May 17th, from 10 to 6 at the Coshocton Village Inn. The community is invited. We look forward to seeing you.
Thank you for being with us today. That's our time for the morning with Nick Teddy and Tim Kettler from Coshocton Environmental and Community Awareness. This is WTNS-FM Coshocton. It's 10 o'clock.